From the heavenly realm of Asgard, this is the Film Confessional Podcast. Thanks for listening to me today. My name's Justin, and with me today is...
Jason.
And with us as well today is our very special friends from the Read Comics Podcast. Wow. Marty and Florence, and of course, Colleen, as always. So thanks for coming back on yet again. How are you guys doing today?
Very well. Thanks for coming over.
Very good. Are we excited to talk about some Odin sleep and Odin realm and, you know, on our nice little Odin cast?
I'm ready.
Are you winging this, Justin?
Only a little bit. If this is your first time listening in, the Film Confessional Podcast is a regular Valhalla of weekly movie podcasts. We discuss any and all things cinematic, from the mightiest blockbusters to the puniest of independent fare. This week we'll be discussing Thor, the first in a large lineup of countless comic book movie adaptations this summer. But let's kick off this show, as always, with our host spotlight segment, where each of us takes the time to discuss our thoughts on a movie, good or bad, but noteworthy enough for us to share our thoughts about. Florence, would you care to kick us off today?
Sure. In a very rare turn of events, I saw two movies in 2 weeks.
Wow.
And the second movie I saw all by myself as a little treat one afternoon while Marty played with Colleen. And I see Bridesmaids.
Oh, I see it tomorrow. I'm
oh,
so
really?
Excited.
I really enjoyed it.
I heard it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it helped that I really had no idea what to expect.
Sure.
I hadn't seen the trailer. I just heard it was dumb.
Mm-hmm.
And all I knew was that Paul Feig was involved, who is someone I have great affection for since Freaks and Geeks.
Of course.
And I trust that what I'd heard about the movie was that the trailer made it look like another dumb women fighting each other kind of movie. And I just didn't believe that he would be involved in something like that.
Okay.
And I read an interview with him where he talked a little more about how it really was about, you know, true friendships between women and how that was something that he felt was important to show. And the cast was awesome. I think
mm-hmm.
Maya Rudolph should be in way more things.
Maya Rudolph is pretty great.
Yeah.
So.
I think Kristen Wiig, I've gotten a little bit sick of her on SNL because she just got so much screen time there, but I think she did a fantastic job in the movie.
Yeah. On a side note, can we just say Kristen Wiig does a killer Michelle Bachmann?
Really?
Oh, man.
I haven't seen the season.
Looks just like her. It's a terrible season, but she does a great job.
Well, Michelle Bachmann, it's sort of horrifying to think that she's known on a national stage. It's a little humiliating to be from her state, but glad
oh,
to see
I,
she's being
I was from
scared.
Her state senate district.
Oh.
That's where I grew up, so.
Wow.
Yeah. I've known about her a lot longer than any of you have, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But no, I'm so glad that you that you really responded to Bridesmaids, because I actually had the exact same reaction to you with the trailer, or in the sense that it looked like, you know, a standard generic, you know, romantic comedy flick. And, you know, I think, you know, a lot of people have been comparing it to that Something Borrowed, I think it is, another romantic comedy of some kind that has Kate Hudson in it that
mm-hmm.
looks just absolutely rancid. And, you know, I think that says more about the way the movie is marketed than anything else. And,
agreed.
You know, that's, I think it's just another example of how aware you have to be when you're actually consuming, like, trailers and whatnot, because clearly this movie is up to something a little bit, you know, a lot more interesting, so.
Agreed. But yeah, and it was interesting that I spent the next couple of days quoting parts to Marty, too. Oh, and one of the
and
people,
making me want to see it.
Yeah. One of the people that was in it that I had no idea was in it, in that great cast, was a boy who stars in the British TV show The IT Crowd.
Okay.
Which we're all huge fans of here.
Yes.
We have all the seasons on DVD.
Yeah,
nice.
It's very funny, and he is just does an excellent job in the mold of the Paul Feig good boy, which is more likely to be sort of abused by women than the other way around. But I really liked his whole vibe and the fact that he wasn't cartoony. He played it really well. And I think held his own with a cast that was primarily focused on women.
Sure.
Which was possibly refreshing.
Yeah, definitely. And I have to say, you know, very rarely do I actually get extremely gratified by box office results. I've learned to become really jaded towards them, but I think the box office results, the success of this movie has, I think it opened to like $24 million, like second place, and it wasn't and it played against Priest, which is, you know, a movie that came out the same weekend, you know, catering much more ostensibly to that, you know, sweet spot, that age 18 to 34 male audience.
Yeah.
So it was really gratifying to see that sort of fail. Not that it's really fair to really enjoy the failure of other people's business, but, you know, it's great to see something with this kind of, I think it's safe to say, social significance.
Yeah.
You know, because it's clearly speaking to people in a really interesting way.
Right, well, and I mean, obviously, the marketing didn't hurt it if
no.
it's making that box office, but I'm hoping that people who are seeing it are walking away happier than people who are going to see Something Borrowed because they've just got to kill some time and want to see something that doesn't involve murdering weird CGI monsters. Not that I'm against that as a category, but Priest did look kind of
looked extremely generic. But, well, very cool. Thank you so much for sharing about that. You just got me that much more excited about seeing the movie tomorrow. So, I think I will go next. The reason I wanted...
Pauline's going to go next.
Yes, she is. The reason I wanted to talk about this movie for my spotlight pick, I don't know if you guys read in the news a couple of weeks ago. Are we still going?
Yeah.
Yep. If you read in the news a couple of weeks ago, but, you know, there was this one story, I think it was sort of pushed onto, like, you know, page 12 of Section B in the newspaper, but the president actually enacted this military operation that killed Osama bin Laden. So I'm not sure if you guys have heard that at all. I mean,
wait, they already made a movie about that?
No, they didn't. But you know, I'm sure, like everyone else, I just you know, it really sort of came out of nowhere as kind of a shock. And so one of the more interesting sort of phenomenons, which I think we can all agree was just the, you know, the response, the knee-jerk response that everyone had to this. I mean, there were people mm-hmm. celebrating in the streets, and I heard one person shout into a CNN camera that he had a final the next day, but he's not studying for it because we got bin Laden. And, you know, to be honest, like, it seemed... as much as I can sort of understand and identify with that, you know, very cathartic sort of, you know, feeling, I mean, there's still something really kind of unsettling inherently about, you know, political murder in a way, because in a sense it is still murder. And, you know, how are we supposed to respond to that? I mean, how do we deal with that? And so the movie I wanted to talk about, because the most recent current events prompted me to actually sit down and watch this almost 3-hour-long movie, was one of Steven Spielberg's most recent films, his movie Munich, which was co-written by Tony Kushner. So has anyone here seen Munich at all?
I haven't heard a lot about it.
No? Okay. Well, it's one of his more beloved movies, I think, and also one of his more hated movies from the last 10 years for... because of how sort of difficult the movie is in a lot of ways. It's about it's about Israel's covert response to the 1971 Munich Olympics massacre, kidnapping and then massacre by these Palestinian terrorists of these Israeli athletes. And it stars Eric Bana, and I believe it has Daniel Craig, you know, the new James Bond, he's in it as well. And they team up as, you know, these assassins with three other guys to actually carry out these covert operations to kill the masterminds behind the Munich massacre. And so, you know, it plays up, you know, especially at the beginning, as this very sort of taut, you know, political revenge thriller, but then, you know, toward the end, the movie sort of runs out of steam, not in the sense that the movie quality, the quality of the film runs out of steam, but in the sense that these characters begin to come to terms with, you know, what they're actually doing. They're able to put their murder into context. And there's this really great scene where they, you know, I won't give too much away. It involves this, you know, Dutch assassin who's not part of the crew, and they confront her. And it's absolutely just brutally cold, and in a way that really, it's a huge turning point where you really begin to question, you know, the futility of this kind of violence, what the implications are for political murder, what, you know, what's the benefit, what's the cost. And you know, I think it's it It's not his best film. My favorite Spielberg film is still, Spielberg films are still Schindler's List and Rage of the Lost Ark. But I would say, like, you know, even those, they have this kind of ideological purity where, you know, the bad guys were super bad and the good guys were super good. And this one definitely has a much more interesting sort of, you know, gray area that Spielberg doesn't really explore all that often in his movies, if at all. And, you know, I was really happy to see him, you know, come up with the to actually face this challenge. For the most part, he handles it, you know, very elegantly. There are some moments of clumsiness, I think particularly toward the beginning. And, you know, there are these flashbacks where they actually depict the Olympics massacre, which I think are completely unnecessary. But for me, I just, you know, was completely riveted watching this movie a second time, mm-hmm. a third time. And, you know, I hope people actually take the time to see it because I think, you know, I think it's, you know, just as relevant now as it was 5 years ago, as difficult as it could be to watch. So.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I had a similar, really ambivalent feeling about the Osama of announcement.
Mm-hmm.
We were actually watching Doctor Who at the time. And
not Celebrity Apprentice. So.
No. Okay. And got texts started coming in and mm-hmm. something was going down and we decided to finish the episode before learning more. But we actually did watch the live presidential announcement after, you know, by the time we turned on the TV.
Oh, yeah.
It was on.
Too.
And, it actually really bothered me that a couple of people I was friends with on Facebook were, like, outright celebratory about it.
Yeah.
Most of my friends, most of the people I've known the longest, were really posting about feeling ambivalent and a little bit queasy about
the
celebration.
Yeah. You know, and I can't say I shared that sort of ambivalence. When I thought about it, when I actually calmed down, I actually thought about what that sort of unbridled celebration actually means. But, you know, I was admittedly on, and I was saying these very sort of internet snarky sort of things on my Facebook wall. I think I said something to the extent of, the president's going to announce it in a little bit, but I'm the one who got Bin Laden.
I actually thought that was funny.
Yeah, so I mean, I in my defense, I did stop just short of saying, you know, all right, we killed the bastard.
Mm-hmm.
USA, USA. But, you know, there is this sort of... I think everyone can sort of identify this very visceral gut reaction that they had because, you know, because his death is definitely sort of a milestone in this event that has defined so many people's lives for the last 10 years to some extent. So
I just never, not never, I mean, I don't have as strong of an identification about 9/11, I think, as some
sure.
people.
I think that's the part that...
Yeah.
What you were just saying that is the thing that I have trouble with is that so many people let that event define such a big part of their life, no matter where in the country they were.
No,
that's...
Right. Well, here's the thing. I mean, regardless of whether it was, you know, September 11th was a very personal sort of...
Mm-hmm.
If you had a very personal relationship to it, I mean, I didn't know anyone who
mm-hmm.
was attacked or even tangentially related to that attack. But at the same time, there was still this noticeable cultural shift that actually took place, cultural and political. And, you know, it's come to define a lot of, you know, the media and entertainment that we, and, you know, that we consume and information, basically.
Yep.
So I suppose that's mostly what I mean by the way that single event has been able to.
But we should.
Maybe we should
come back to
Marty. I am particularly interested in hearing about your spotlight pick because apparently none of us have seen it.
Yep. None of you have seen it, and it's a documentary.
Ooh.
I watched the other night when I was up late by myself, and it's called Toyland. Fun in the Making, and it's basically a toy inventor by the name of Ken Sons, who, actually, I'm not sure that's true.
He's reading the back of the DVD right now.
I think that's the guy who is...
It's produced and directed by.
Oh, no, wait. It's actually Tim Walsh. So the main director and producer of the movie is Ken Sons. But the toy inventor in the movie is Tim Walsh. And he has this game prototype that he's pitching to all the toy producers, and, you know, like Hasbro and Mattel and the big ones. And he's carting it around to these different toy conventions that exist and that happen. And I think the movie takes place over the course of like 2 or 3 years. And toward the end, he's saying things like, you know, I've never pitched a single idea this long. This is really like, this isn't a kind of, you know, suicide. Like, I shouldn't be doing this. You know, and it evolves over the course of the movie. But also they interview and talk to sort of the inventors of a lot of different, like, really well-known toys. Like, the woman whose husband invented Slinky, who's, like, you know, 80-something, was really fascinating to hear from. And I forget, some of the other people were just, you know, these people who had, you know, some of them had profited from these toys that, you know, everyone knows.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them just hadn't even seen a dime. Like, there was this elderly couple who had essentially invented Play-Doh. And it sounds like maybe their brother-in-law is the one who, you know, actually, or I'm sorry, their son-in-law is the one who, you know, kind of took it and made it into a name that we all know. But, you know, it's kind of interesting that this woman had essentially, like, she hadn't invented it. She just read about this formula for, you know, making putty, and she was a teacher, and she made it for her kids in the classroom, and, you know, and she was like, this is great. Somebody's got to make this and, you know, sell it. And so someone else took it and ran with it, and they even, like, called her and, you know, said, we're thinking about calling it, you know, and they had some really lame name for it. And she's like, no, don't call it that. We'll call you back with a name. And like 2 or 3 hours later, they called the guy back and were like, no, you got to call it Play-Doh. And so he called it that, and, you know, the rest is history. Anyway, there were a lot of really interesting stories in here. And the story of Tim Walsh was also pretty interesting.
That's very cool. And Tim Walsh, I'm assuming his is the principal narrative, and they just sort of branch out to all these different ones. Is it supposed to be sort of about the process of pushing a toy through the line, or just sort of that very, you know, mundane, cumbersome process of getting something through all the different channels? Or
I don't know. It seems like it is kind of about the idea of invention. I mean, definitely. You know, in addition to sort of the mundane details of how you get a toy to, you know, to production, to see store shelves and things like that, it also, you know, talks a bit about how do you come up with an idea and how do you know it's a good idea and that sort of thing. It is kind of his narrative. It's his story, and then the, you know, but with the interesting bits thrown in between, I think, are, you know, all about these other ideas. And you get more than that, too. I mean, there's, like, there's a school that specializes in toy design that they kind of go to and sort of see. And they interview a couple of different, like, companies that do, like, you know, toy production and stuff. And you get to see sort of them from the inside. And that's interesting.
So, what side of the debate does it come on? Are toys good or are toys bad at the end of this movie?
I don't think there's any question. Toys are obviously always good.
Okay. Okay, that's good. That's wipe the sweat off my brow. And
right.
That's an awesome pick. I actually really want to check out that documentary, Toyland.
Yeah, you're welcome to borrow it. This is one of two documentaries about board games and toys that I bought at the Chicago Toy and Game Fair this last year.
Nice.
The other one is all about Monopoly.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, and there's a Kickstarter project right now about Euro games, about board games out of Europe, that Euro games are sort of a whole subgenre of board games. And
speaking of
Florence just gestured to into
the mini bins
living space.
Here.
Speaking of Monopoly.
Yeah.
A quick aside here, and also a shameless plug. There's a new version of Monopoly that's being released soon. Actually, I think it's already available for pre-order. Doctor Who Monopoly.
Mm.
Really?
Really. And one of the guests at Galaxicon in 2012 was instrumental in getting it approved to actually be released.
Yeah.
So,
Well, Monopoly is sort of famous for having a million different...
Well, now it is. I mean...
sort of branded versions.
Yeah. I mean, before it was just, you know, geographical variations. But kind of in the 80s, probably, is when they started putting out the various branded versions.
Yeah, I wonder when they
versions.
Started doing that.
I mean,
because
there's always been the London version of Monopoly. Well, I mean, not always,
always.
But
at some point.
For the longest time, there's been... Anyways,
sure. Well, that's an awesome pick, Marty. Thanks. Jason, why don't you close up the segment with your spotlight pick?
All right, my spotlight pick is actually not about a specific movie.
Okay.
It's about an article that I read recently from Newsweek.
The Roger Ebert article.
The Roger Ebert article from Newsweek.
Good article for the most part.
The Summer Movie Special Sequel Madness article. And... what I want to touch on is specifically a message that Roger Ebert got from Paul Schrader.
The guy who wrote Taxi Driver.
And directed American Gigolo. He also wrote Raging Bull.
He wrote Raging... Okay.
Well, it says screenplays, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull.
Okay. And he also directed All That Jazz, I believe.
Okay.
The section
in the article here... I'll just read from the article.
Yeah, please do.
I heard earlier this month from Paul Schrader, whose films and screenplays show a distinctive vision. He informed me that grown-up films and creative projects were over, in quotes, in the new Hollywood, and that many of his friends are turning to long-form television. He emailed, "The quality of theatrically released films has been dropping so precipitously in recent years that the Academy Awards are no longer a fair gauge of audiovisual entertainment. Several decades ago, audiences could expect a film such as The Social Network every week. Now we are lucky to have one or two a year."
I think that's a little bit of an exaggeration.
Add to this
the fact
serious dramas have more or less migrated to television, and it's clear that the Oscars have become progressively less relevant. Last year, arguably the best male performance of the year, Al Pacino in You Don't Know Jack, was not eligible for the Oscars.
It was an HBO
movie.
Directed
by Barry Levinson.
That was the best performance of the year. But...
it was apparently not possible for Pacino, Levinson, and a touchy subject to interest a major studio. This is now Roger Ebert writing. It won an Emmy, but I confess I hadn't heard of it until Paul mentioned it. Rotten Tomatoes doesn't list a single review of it. Was it eligible for the Oscars? No. Made for TV. Kate Winslet's work in Mildred Pierce is also not eligible. So, yeah, basically... it's an article about Roger Ebert talking about, I don't want to say the death of Hollywood per se, but...
this very sort of cynical, gradual turn that Hollywood has very, very efficiently cemented itself into.
Pretty much. I mean, he talks about how studios just really are not... that Hollywood studios no longer seem to be interested in taking chances at all anymore.
That's true.
That they are, well, I mean, he basically says that, you know, it's, they're run by accountants, and it's all a question of profit, or not profit, loss, what's the?
Cost-benefit?
That movies are made by cost-benefit analysis in Hollywood.
So are most TV shows.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I would agree with that. It seems a little... sometimes I feel that maybe the success of... well, no, I don't actually think that. Never mind.
What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say, I almost want to say that maybe the measurability of a TV show's success could arguably be a little bit more difficult than that of a film, but at the same, I'm not sure I necessarily buy that argument, which is why... stop myself halfway through my sentence.
What he's kind of getting at is that the Hollywood system has pretty much painted itself into a corner, kind of, and you know they have one specific market that they're going after, which is the, what is it, 14 to 34 males,
something like that.
They don't seem to have any interest. They don't feel that any other market apparently spends enough money.
Well, so then no chick flicks that ever be made? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, you know, very few are, and the ones that are, I mean, Bridesmaids is the exception. Most of the movies marketed to women are such crap.
I feel like
well,
they're the exact same movie across the board.
Most movies, period.
Well,
are
but
such
that's
crap.
Here's the thing: is
it's
that
not,
okay? They have the chick flicks, but how different are the chick flicks from each other?
That's the low risk.
I mean, they're
yeah.
they have a very, very similar sort of narrative arc to all of them.
Well,
and
what he's kind of getting at is that Hollywood isn't taking chances by making sure that a movie that comes out can be compared to one or a dozen other movies. And I mean, sure, you can say that with just about any movie from anywhere, but it's gotten really bad. Is what I think Ebert is saying. And he specifically talks about sequels and how there are more sequels and series movies coming out this year than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think last year there were more sequels and such than ever before. And
I think this summer is going to...
This summer,
I believe, is... I think it says in that Newsweek article that this summer is the biggest offense when it comes to, you know, movies with
27 sequels.
Yeah. Which is unbelievable. And, you know, I can see where he's coming from in the sense that there is this sort of... you mentioned that studio execs are more like accountants now, and I actually would consider the profession more akin to, like, a marketer or something like that. I feel like so many movies these days, you get the sense. And, you know, to an extent, Thor as well, which is a movie that we're talking about. And, you know,
about superhero comic book franchises in here.
These movies are the culminations of this larger scale marketing campaign of some kind. And,
yep.
you know, really even, it's even gone beyond just the film itself being the final say. I mean, a movie like Thor, movies like Iron Man and Iron Man 2, those are no longer, you know, the end of the tracks with that marketing campaign. They are leading into another larger scale movie.
It's true. They're leading into the Avengers.
So it's becoming much more elaborate, but it's all these movies are following such a similar narrative. And, you know, it's, I think to an extent, yeah, I mean, it's something that's, it's more of an issue of comfort. And, you know, there is that unwillingness to take that gamble because, you know, even the movies that, you know, make $1 billion in the box office, I mean, they spend so much money on actual production costs and marketing the movie itself too. Like I believe the precedent was set by Spielberg's Jurassic Park, which I think the marketing for that movie actually cost more than the movie itself.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But you know, so there is this, I mean, there is this reliable business model that they have to follow now. And, you know, the risks just seem way too scary, which, you know, which is another reason why, and I know Jason, you're not too nuts about the movie, but it was very gratifying to see a movie like Black Swan, which cost only $14 million to make. I think worldwide it just went over the $300 million mark. You know, there are daring filmmakers who actually have some sort of ostensible vision who,
mm-hmm.
you know, who, I mean, there is a market out there. There is that sort of recognition. And you could say the same thing about the Coen brothers' True Grit, which was a movie that didn't cost too much. It never made it number one in the box office, or at least it didn't the first or second weekend, I think. But then people kept going to see it, and it ended up making more money than I think the Chronicles of Narnia movie did, and I think they both came out around the same time. So, you know, there has to be this willingness to accept some sort of risk to actually, you know, if they're going to break free from this mold, they have to trust the filmmakers to some extent, because there aren't great masterpieces coming out, you know, at the same rate as there were in, like, the 1970s when you had the Coppolas in the world and the new Hollywood brats, but at the same time...
way fewer movies coming out every weekend.
Yeah, that's true, too. But, you know, you do have, like, the Paul Thomas Andersons, the Darren Aronofskys of the world now, who, you know, people really need to start putting more stock into the work that they're doing.
Yeah. Well, and you say you trust the filmmakers. What I'd also like to see them do a little bit more is trust the audiences.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's so much better.
I agree. I feel that is the... one of the biggest things is that they do not... Well, he talks about trailers in here. Trailers also do their best to spoil secrets and sight gags for you.
Mm-hmm.
One executive told me, we want them to feel like they're seeing the whole movie, except that it's longer. This model can also be found in the aisles of supermarkets, where you're offered a bite of cheese on a toothpick. After you eat it, you know everything there is to know about that cheese, except what it would be like to eat a pound of it.
I really love that analogy. I think that's perfect.
So it's interesting, because it reminds me of a conversation I saw at a panel at Minicon last month, which was by published writers, and they said that it used to be that all you need to do was find an editor, and that editor would champion, if they believed in your manuscript, they would champion it and get it approved, and then work with you to get it published. Now there's actually a committee of editors and marketing people that need to have a vision for how it could be marketed, where it will go on a shelf, before they'll greenlight it to even get an editor assigned.
Yeah. I wonder.
I think it is there is a deeper root to the problem in that it all has to do with investors at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it really is that, everything, all these publishers and studios and everything are publicly traded, and it's all about returns to the investors.
Yeah. You know,
And I think some of this, too, has to do with the long tail, it's basically, not impossible to make a movie now on a shoestring budget, in a way that, it's easier now than it ever has been before.
Technology's improved so vastly.
That's true for books as well, and probably most other technologies. I mean, certainly music. You can now do stuff yourself that would have taken a whole production crew before to do. And, I think, I'm not sure exactly how that feeds into this, but in a way, what you're saying may be true of the mainstream, but certainly, overall, there are more movies being made any given weekend. There are more, there are more types of movie. There's definitely more, and just because Roger Ebert doesn't see them, I just kind of feel like...
Well, the thing about you saying that is that Roger Ebert sees a lot. I mean, that's kind of his job. He's at Cannes right now seeing a whole lot that we are never going to see.
He does tend to paint his arguments in very broad strokes. And to be fair, he is a print journalist. He only gets so many hundreds of words to write an article. It's difficult to make a really articulate, thorough, and nuanced argument. But I think he is sort of catering to a larger general problem that, there isn't necessarily that much facility for actual challenging filmmaking to actually pierce through. In some sort of meaningful way. And, he sort of talks about this at the end, and I think this actually, this was actually a big disappointment in the article that he wrote for me, but part of me wonders, an analogy would have to be the music industry. I think conventional wisdom for so many people is that the reason the music industry is in as much trouble as it is because they did not have the foresight to actually invest in the development of technology that would be at the consumer's disposal, which is, by focusing too much on upselling the cost of discs, that really caused an issue. And I hate to say it because I love the theater going experience. The actual experience of going to the movie theater is particularly meaningful to me emotionally, but at the same time, the truth of the matter is that is not how the majority of movie consumers or movie watchers are actually consuming their films at this point. There are streaming technologies that are available now. There is video on demand, which is actually proving to be relatively successful now. I feel like another option studios need to do is that, and this is actually a really ballsy move that they would have to take. They would actually have to fundamentally change their business structure in a way that that more meaningfully accommodates that kind of interactive technology. And I don't necessarily see them doing that anytime soon, but I think in a way that could actually help get a lot of, a lot of lesser known products, a lot more availability if you are able to just watch it on your screen on demand.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, and I think, you know, I think you're wrong that they're not embracing it, actually.
Okay.
I think the studios are all keenly aware that they are going to have to embrace it. And it's sort of, you know, a balancing act between, like, trying to continue to milk the theater-going, you know, cash cow, and also, like, you know, slowly embracing the technologies in such a way that, you know, they're still in control and still making as much money as they want to. Which is, you know, the heart of why it's difficult, I think, because, you know, with sort of the dissemination of technology, I mean, with the different channels becoming more and more available, the margins are going to be lower, you know? And I think so, well, I don't know. Anyway, so you do hear about, you know, such and such movie coming out simultaneously, you know, I don't know.
It's happening more now.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would counter that by saying, you know, yes, there is an increase, but I would say that there is still a significant amount of resistance to the push for that move. I mean, you have so much studio money going into these campaigns to try to combat movie piracy, for example, when, you know, really their money, my opinion is their money would be so much more smartly spent if they were investing it on that new technology. But there is that element of defense to defend the old way of consuming this media.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's very reminiscent of the attack on Napster.
Exactly. And, you know, I feel like...
It's the same.
Yeah, and I feel like there are just lessons that should have been learned that aren't being adhered to. And, you know, that's that's my big thing. They aren't actually... I feel like not enough... Again, this plays back to your argument, Jason, or dovetails into it, I think, rather nicely, that people aren't giving enough credit to the consumers to make their decisions, to consume their media.
Yeah. I really honestly feel that they don't trust that consumers are going to... That's exactly it. They don't trust that consumers are going to choose their product, so they are making sure that their product is shoved down the consumer's throat,
mm-hmm.
whether they want it or not.
Well, and that's exactly, I mean, that is the danger. Like, if more movies are made available, you know, all the time, which they are,
mm-hmm.
no matter what, you know, then less people are going to buy the mainstream ones. And,
yeah.
you know, the hit-driven market that we're in now, the scenario that we're in now, is just not going to exist forever, and it's only a matter of time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, everything's going to be so different, we're not even going to recognize it.
Yeah.
Anyway,
okay. Well,
that
was an awesome discussion.
Yes.
Thanks for talking about that. That very good. And those are our spotlight picks for the week. But before we move on, just a reminder to subscribe to our show on iTunes if you've not done so yet. We have a link to our iTunes page included in this week's show notes, but you can also find us by typing the Film Confessional Podcast in your iTunes search engine. iTunes also allows users to write reviews, so if you have any constructive thoughts on our show, positive or negative, please feel free to post them as an iTunes review. Now let's move on to our big discussion of the week, which is a review of Thor, the new film by director Kenneth Branagh, in which stars Chris Hemsworth, Anthony Hopkins, and Natalie Portman. Thor came into theaters a couple of weeks ago, marking itself as the summer's first major blockbuster, and the latest in a string of would-be tentpole franchises. It's based on the popular comic book series of the same name, and the Norse demigod of the same name as well. And it just also happens to be the latest in a series of films leading up to the Joss Whedon superhero orgy, The Avengers, which I think, Florence, you're actually particularly looking forward to.
It was pretty much the reason I saw this movie.
Yes. Well, Branagh's adaptation of Thor kicks off with a trio of storm-chasing scientists, led by Portman as Jane Foster, who I believe is a character from the comics.
Yes.
Okay.
She's a nurse in the comics.
Yeah. She's a nurse in the comics. Okay.
A nurse, yes.
Okay. Well, she and her crew stumbles in the middle of this New Mexico desert across this giant, hulking, absolutely ripped, gorgeous man, and we learn that this man is, in fact, not a man, but he is Thor, the detective.
Now, would you say they really stumbled across him?
Well, they ran into him, I guess.
Yeah.
Fair enough. But his name is Thor. He's the dejected son of Odin, the supreme ruler of the distant realm of Asgard. for arrogantly inciting war between his people and the Frost Giants, inhabitants of another distant realm. We learn Odin has stripped Thor of his powers and banished him to the realm of Earth for the remainder of his days. As Jane helps Thor acclimate himself to his new home, we are privy to the Asgardian family drama left in Thor's dust. A distraught Odin falls into a coma, which is cleverly referred to as the Odin sleep. I liked that. Leaving Thor's jealous and corrupt brother Loki, who's played by Tom Hiddleston, to reign tyrannically over his realm, much to the chagrin of Thor's friends, whose names frankly escape me, and I think for good reason.
That would go ahead. Hogan, Fandral, and Volstagg, the Warriors Three.
Okay, the Volkswagen Warriors.
As well as Sif, who is kind of his kind of girlfriend in Asgard, but he, you know, quickly forgets about her.
Well, I think the movie sort of quickly forgets about her and all the other ones as well, but we'll talk about that later.
Well, when you've got to choose between her and Princess Amidala.
Well, we'll talk about that too. His friends proceed to retrieve Thor from Earth and to save Asgard. So, does that sound convoluted? I kind of think it does. I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit. But Florence and Marty, and I guess this applies to you, Jason, as well, I'm particularly excited to have you all here for this week's episode because, and this may be a small confession on my part, I have no meaningful familiarity with Thor either as a relic of Norse mythology nor as a comic book hero. So I'm going to kick off this discussion by asking this. As comic book connoisseurs, what is your relationship to Thor as an intellectual property? And does Kenneth Branagh do any kind of justice to the expectations that you may or may not have had coming into this movie? Anyone can start.
Sure. Well, my familiarity with Thor as a comic comes from our friend Mike, who loaned me a short arc of the comic, I guess a few years ago now. Before we knew that there was going to be a movie coming.
Was this the ones written by Straczynski?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Who, J. Michael Straczynski, so I've read.
So he actually wrote this too. Straczynski had a part in the script for this movie.
That's right. Okay.
His name was in the credits anyway. And he's written tons of movies.
Right, and comics as well.
And he wrote this TV series, you know, I mean.
You might have heard of it.
I don't know that. Anyone really? It was something called like Deep Space Five or something like
that. Babylon 5, which was my which I have seen start to finish.
Is that an 80s movie? I'm kidding. Continue.
And it is the reason why when I spot his name on comics, I generally read them even if I don't know much else about them. Except that he's taken over the Wonder Woman franchise recently, which I think is a terrible fit. But anyway. So I had, you know, read some of the comics, and so a lot of the characters and the framing of the mythology in this universe were very familiar to me. The Norse mythology, I don't know much of.
No.
They're major characters in American Gods by Neil Gaiman, so I have a certain interpretation of them from that, which is very different from this interpretation. I have a lot more familiarity and affection for Greek mythology, and... And so I think I drew some parallels there that did not serve my appreciation for the movie at all, really. I spent a ridiculous amount of the first part of the movie, like, just objecting in my mind to portraying any kind of ancient macho mythology in this particular way.
The beginning is so rough for so many reasons, but which I'm sure we'll talk about later.
I actually had to, like, talk myself down and realizing, like, okay, I don't actually know this mythology that well to object this strongly. Like, I don't know for sure that it was as wrong as I felt.
Well, I have a theory about that, but unless you had anything else you wanted to add at the front end, I'm interested to hear Marty's reaction.
Yeah, I mean, so I have only read exactly the same arc of Thor. Unlike many of the other comics that we sort of pick and choose a particular arc of. I didn't get into it enough that I wanted to read more, or did read more. I don't know. There's something about it that's just... I mean, it's kind of... It's not magic, but it's kind of, you know, it's kind of like...
It's science.
Comics based on religion. Like, so, interestingly, the comic, I feel, doesn't pretend to be science fiction. Mm-hmm. And this movie could have been science fiction. I mean, pretty much was science fiction. So, like, the idea is that there's, you know, these seven other worlds, and really, they're probably planets out in space. And, you know, they're all linked by wormholes. And, you know, Thor...
They even call them wormholes in the movie.
Yeah, they do. And the magic of Thor and his world is referred to as science. I mean, essentially, like, you know, he's saying, like, you know, magic and science are the same thing for them.
Sure.
Anyway, so, like, I did like that aspect of it. I've always liked that trope that, you know, magic is really just science we don't understand yet. But I felt like this movie left out a lot of sort of the base material for the comic, which one of the things... All right, Colleen paused the playback there. So one of the things that was sort of intrinsic to the comic is that... Thor is not always Thor. He has kind of an alter ego, which is like a normal human, I think. And basically, like, when this guy has the hammer, and I'm not really sure how he gets it, I forget.
Straczynski went back to the basics of the Thor comic.
Uh-huh.
You had Donald Blake, who was a doctor... And he was lame. That was what they called it back in the 60s. He was lame. He had a bad leg. And he walked with a cane. And he was exploring his heritage in Norway. He was exploring his heritage in Norway when he gets trapped by a rock slide. There's also aliens involved. rock aliens, in fact.
Okay.
And he finds a wooden stick with weird carvings, I think, on it. And his leg is trapped. And he thought he can take this stick and use it as a lever to free his leg. And it doesn't work, and he gets frustrated, so he slams the stick on the ground. Stick becomes the hammer of Thor.
Right.
And he turns into Thor, and then lift himself out. He's strong, he's beautiful, he has long blonde hair. And throughout the course of the early series, you find out that he was banished to Earth by his father to teach him humility.
Right.
And given this human form to learn humility as well. A human form that is crippled.
Okay.
To learn humility.
So he is, in fact, the same character.
It is the same character. Although Straczynski played with that a little bit in that, like, Blake and Thor are two facets of the character that, like, talk to each other in, you know, in a
so that,
astral plane
somewhat.
So that's
not necessarily part of canon?
Well, it is now. It is now. New canon. Now, here's the thing. The movie doesn't follow that... comic thread.
Right.
The movie follows more of the Ultimate line of comics, which pretty much all of the movies have been following that.
Do you think mostly because it's leading up to this Avengers movie?
Marvel a number of years ago started what they called their Ultimate line, which was basically relaunching all of their major characters from day one, basically.
Well, except
updated.
Iron Man
twists.
Was not Ultimate Iron Man.
It was actually quite a bit Ultimate Iron Man. Did you read the Ultimate Iron Man series?
I read the beginnings of it, and
there was
like his son and the
it was a
blue
lot
skin and stuff.
It was
like,
a lot closer to the Ultimate Iron Man series. Than the original.
Am I thinking of something
actually, no,
totally
you know what?
Different?
No, you're right. You're right. Absolutely right. Iron Man is the exception. Iron Man followed more of the origins of the original Iron Man.
Yeah.
But the Samuel Jackson certainly matches the ultimate version.
Of Nick Fury.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right.
Well, Samuel L. Jackson is the ultimate version of anything.
Yeah.
just saying.
But, this is what Thor is following, is the ultimate story. Where he never has the Donald Blake alter ego.
Okay.
Okay.
He does, you know, get depowered, but
Yeah, he gets it back pretty early in the film.
And, okay, so the whole thing where he goes, he breaks in to find the hammer. Was anyone surprised that he couldn't pick up the hammer?
No,
I think I wasn't sure, but, you know, I haven't read the comics, and I'm not terribly familiar, so.
Well, the whole idea with Thor's hammer is that you have to be worthy in order to be able to pick up the hammer. And there have been other people in the Marvel Universe who have been able to wield Thor's hammer.
I think Wonder Woman was able to.
But I was just going to let that go.
Well, no, but I read this one comic, like Marvel versus DC, and I think Wonder Woman hands Thor his hammer, and Thor just is completely incredulous.
I think what Jason wasn't going to touch was the fact that Wonder Woman handled Thor's hammer.
Oh, okay. I assumed I violated some sort of fanboy purism, but it turns out I was violating something completely different.
Anyway. Okay.
As was Wonder Woman.
In the movie, Thor's hammer falls to Earth separately from him. And Thor breaks into where the government has the hammer, you know, like, they've been trying to...
It's essentially like a fallen star.
Yeah.
Some kind of fallen...
And everyone's trying to go and take the hammer, and no one can do it because they're not worthy.
Yeah.
And Thor goes to get the hammer because he's like, I'm Thor, I'll be worthy. Except he's not worthy yet.
Right. And I think that was probably the best action set piece in the whole movie. If you ask me.
I agree.
It's not as reliant on special effects, and there's actually some sort of sense of gravity to the whole thing. So, and I didn't actually mind the guy with the lasers shooting out of his face, whatever his name is.
Yeah.
I didn't mind that scene where he was attacking everyone in the New Mexico village. I thought that was kind of neat too, but.
Really?
Yeah,
I thought that was pretty bad. That was one of the worst scenes.
Oh no, I think the worst action scene in the movie is probably the very first action sequence.
The fight with
against the frost giants.
In fact, that was so bad I blocked it completely out of my memory.
Well, I think the sort of moving back to the movie for at least a little bit. I think that, you know, the biggest pratfall for this movie, and this is a movie that ultimately I did enjoy quite a bit, not having any sort of relationship to the Thor character, it sort of surprised me in that respect, but there's a really clumsy handling of the world building at the very beginning of this movie. You start with an okay scene with Natalie Portman and her crew, just sort of driving around in the middle of the desert chasing the storm, and then for no rhyme or reason, they completely transition to this kind of flashback, this backstory, just laying out all the exposition as to how Thor got into, how he got dejected from Asgard and landed in this New Mexico desert. And that was the reason why that's so clumsy, such clumsy storytelling, I mean, partly is you are completely getting rid of any sort of sense of mystery or tension about this character. There's no sense of discovery. And, really you're sort of putting all your cards on the table at one time. And that was really unfortunate. But, you know, where the movie sort of clung back onto me is the way it handled so much of this material, which I think has an inherently silly quality to it. I mean, at least if you're going to be depicting it in a live-action motion picture. With all this talk of Asgard and Odin's sleep and, all these other sort of Norse terms that I'm not really familiar with. Marty, you refer to this as sort of taking a turn into the sci-fi realm. I would sort of make it a step, I would narrow down that definition, and I would call it a flat-out space opera, more than anything. And the reason is because, they don't really explore the scientific elements of this world building at any point. And to an extent, I'm kind of glad that they didn't, because I don't think the screenwriter or the director or any of the performers had any sort of facility to be able to convey that convincingly.
Yeah.
So, I was happy that they just sort of, in a sense that they just sort of clumsily got it out of the way and then I could move on with my life. But, I think, the core meat in this movie is this sort of family drama and this sort of core relationship between Thor and Jane, and whether or not that was successful is a different discussion, but, you know, I really did sort of enjoy those character moments, seeing all that, seeing all the crossing and double-crossing, and, you know, to see how all that played out in this hyper-dramatic way, and which is something that I think the director, Kenneth Branagh, is actually suited very well for. Because Kenneth Branagh, I don't know if you guys are familiar too much with his work, but he is the only person, the only director, film director, who has ever been able to direct an actor to convincingly deliver the line, "I am slain." Like, that's what I credit him with, principally.
Okay.
And so, it was Hamlet.
Right.
I
thought he did a good job of Much Ado About Nothing. I think he's, and he has...
That's my favorite of his movies,
yeah,
for sure.
I mean, he has a Shakespearean background, but he also had a comedy background. He'd done a lot of comedy and theater and stuff before being known as the Shakespeare guy. So
yeah.
I was disappointed that there wasn't more comedy in this. I mean, I think Loki is supposed to be, like,
kind of a tragic character.
Well, but I guess, so my concept of Norse mythology, though, is that he's the trickster. He's constantly playing pranks. He's a mean sense of humor, but he's essentially full of clever... He's supposed to be clever. He's supposed to be kind of have a dark sense of humor.
Well,
do you
wonder?
That's my thoughts, but I feel like that was lost.
That was completely gone. Yeah, from this. Like, in fact, he was almost like just a scheming, you know, sort of manipulative, you know, jealous
he's kind of
brother.
He plays this sort of Iago-like character.
Right. Manipulative is right, but it's supposed to be a clever, you know, he's supposed to be. You know, pointing out that Thor's sort of big and dumb heroism is the ideal of mythology in my mind, but Loki is sort of the more relatable one to constantly point out its flaws.
Okay, and I wonder if maybe the they had to get all that set up out of the way in the first movie, and I'm not justifying the approach because you have to have characters actually operate from in an interesting way within the movie itself, but I wonder to what extent they were, you know, getting all of that set up out of the way for him to actually be able to start going into that sort of tricksterism for the inevitable Thor 2, or, you know, spoiler alert, the Avengers movie that's coming up.
I would be very surprised if Loki was a prominent role in the Avengers movie. I mean, I think
it would actually make sense for in the original Avengers run. It is Loki who actually brings them together. Okay, spoiler for a, you know, 40-year-old comic. And I don't know if this is the story that Joss Whedon is working on, but what happens in the Avengers number one is Thor tricks, Loki tricks the Hulk into going on a rampage, and that brings Iron Man, Ant-Man, the Wasp, and Thor together to defeat the Hulk, who ends up joining them to defeat Loki, and thus the Avengers are born as a team.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Didn't either.
So it is Loki, and I mean, definitely in the comics, Loki is a villain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's still a trickster. He's more of the he really is kind of more satanic, really, in that, you know, the Prince of Lies, yes, that is kind of the character he plays.
Okay,
but he is definitely evil, and in fact, I think. His, in actual Norse mythology, he is instrumental in bringing about Ragnarok, which is the end of the world.
Right.
Yeah. So.
So the other thing that really got to me in my concept of these characters.
Quick, what I saw in him in this movie though, is that they really got rid of the evil aspect of his character, because really he was just conflicted.
Mm-hmm.
He was conflicted over his upbringing and his heritage and
that
things
didn't bother
like that.
Me.
Oh, it didn't bother me, because for it to bother me, I
would have had to care.
Which, essentially, when it gets down to it, I just didn't care about this movie. You know, I found it difficult to care about anybody in this movie.
Yeah, it's funny. I spent the early part of it being really bothered by the differences in the my concept of the mythology. And then once I let that go, I didn't care about anything else. Like, I wasn't won over by its charm. I just stopped fighting it. And
but would you say you enjoyed it?
I thought it was a terrible movie. I'll be honest.
Terrible?
Yeah,
wow.
I really did. I mean, I enjoyed going, getting out of the house and seeing a movie, because that's so rare for us. And I felt it was sort of required homework assignment for ultimately seeing the Avengers. But I had no excitement about this movie or the characters based on my experience with the comics. I don't know that they could have made a movie about the set of characters in the story that I would have really connected to at all. But I didn't think that there was enough magic to just transport me into the moment and out of those problems.
To be honest, I think I would have enjoyed it more if they had more of the silliness that
That's
was
so
happening.
Funny.
At the beginning, with, you know, him saying, "You cannot defeat," you know,
it's a little too slapsticky and
yeah,
obvious. Like by the second time they did that, I thought that if they did something like that, I thought, okay, that's getting a little old. But
I can say is that distracted me from the rest of it.
That is so funny, Marty. I have a response to what you guys are saying, but. Marty, I want to give you a chance to speak, like, your general thoughts about the movie. Since we're probably wrapping up.
I think I already did.
Okay.
Already did say a bunch, so I'm
okay.
Not.
All right. Well, you know, you say that you you guys were bored because you had no sort of affection or interest in the characters, and I have to say I completely disagree with you.
Of course you do.
No, I really have to say that because I, especially with the main character, Thor, who I think is played very well, very charmingly, by Chris Hemsworth. I think he does an absolutely terrific job. And I think that he actually is able to convey this, you know, this sort of cocky, brash arrogance, kind of like Han Solo with the big-ass hammer, in a way that it comes off as very charismatic. But at the same time, in his acting, and I don't think this is there in the screenplay at all, I think he's actually able to convey through his facial expressions, especially in that key scene where he's trying to pick up that hammer and he fails, you know, this sort of, you know, feeling of dejection that he actually has, had his privilege robbed of him.
Why have you forsaken me?
Oh, come on. But at the same time, though, I think it does play into this sort of, you know, more inherent silliness that permeates throughout this entire movie, which I think is, you know, much more subtle than I think you're giving it credit for, Jason. I think that this movie embraces that silliness in a very space operatic kind of way, and it worked in a way that, you know, despite that, you know, really clumsy first half hour, I think for the most part it worked incredibly well for me. So, you know, I had a very different reaction, I guess, from you guys.
I think it doesn't help that he is not my type.
He's not my type either, but, you know, it's more...
I do him, but it still didn't help.
Okay. Can I say something else very kind of...
I would also do Fandle.
Can I say something else kind
not
of really...
Stag.
Okay. I'll just wait until Jason pontificates over who he...
I might.
Tom Hiddleston?
Yeah.
Would he have to be wearing the helmet?
No. The helmet was silly.
He'll be worrying about a very different kind of helmet.
Yeah.
But anyway... But no, I will say something very incendiary now. I thought this was actually a superior movie to Iron Man.
And I'm not just
talking about that horrible sequel. I'm talking about the original Iron Man, which is a movie I did not connect with nearly as well as the rest of the world seemed to, apart from that really great lead performance by Robert Downey Jr. I thought that this movie had more interesting performances. I think that it had more interesting sort of heightened drama, and you know, it definitely plays more to this very sort of hyper intense sort of sensibility that I respond to much more strongly than sort of the, you know, really kind of mundane heavy metalness that the first Iron Man movie had.
Wow, I disagree so strongly.
That's okay.
I felt like Iron Man was another character that I'd read a little bit of, but no connection to from comics. And I was so transported and was just filled with glee by the end of it that it completely brought me to the world, and I felt it was fun in a way that this movie just wasn't fun.
And see, I just thought Iron Man was just so visually bland as well. I mean, I have to say, the best thing that could happen to the Iron Man franchise is Jon Favreau leaving the third installment to let someone else helm, because I don't find anything interesting from a filmmaking perspective for Iron Man. And I can't say the same thing for Thor. I think that visually the movie has a lot more interesting stuff going on than, not just from, you know, not just necessarily from camera angles and you know, the way it's actually constructed, but I think, you know, the visual construction of the world is more interesting to me as well.
It's interesting because I actually felt like certainly in contrast, but definitely just even by itself, I felt like the world was so segmented, and it was like, you know, it's
almost as
like,
if they were from completely different dimensions.
Yeah, I mean, sure, but I think more like they were like they were, you know, backdrops, you know, like there were three backdrops and that's what you got. And, you know, even though they were, you know, visually cool, and especially Asgard was really visually very cool.
I could have seen more of that world.
Well, it felt so samey, I guess. I mean, here's the thing, like, you know, it wasn't a fully fleshed out world. It was like one room in a world that just happened to look like a bunch of different rooms, you know?
Yeah,
like,
I didn't. Yeah, I will. In my defense, I didn't say fully fleshed out. It certainly isn't. I'll agree with you on that.
And
visually
even,
more
and
dynamic.
Even Earth, like we only had really like three sets on Earth, right? I mean, we had like her house slash, you know, laboratory.
Her house slash car dealership showroom.
Yeah, yeah, and then the desert where, you know, various things happen, and the city. Which felt like from an early Western where they had, like, you know, one set of cardboard walls and that was it. I felt like that was actually one of the biggest attractors for me. It was the way that the milieu just felt so stilted.
Okay, fair enough. And you do have a point. I mean, it is not perfect in its world building by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, just to me, I think that there is enough visual sort of oomph to the movie, even though it's not necessarily all that, it's not necessarily all that, is the term I'm looking for.
Fleshed out? Elaborate?
Not elaborate, I suppose, but, you know, to me, it was just enough that it just kept me more visually engaged than Iron Man ever did. But we should probably wrap things up. We've been, going on for a while.
Quick thing
let's wrap up our thoughts.
Sure. Mention. I did think it was interesting that they had have another superhero in the movie.
Oh God, they could have totally done away with that. But continue.
What are you talking about?
I'm assuming you're talking about Jeremy Renner as Hawkeye.
Jeremy Renner. Yeah. Renner as Hawkeye. Yeah.
Which, if you know nothing about that character, that scene just feels like it sticks out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, I didn't know enough about the character to really get what's going on.
Yeah, I mean,
seen after the credits?
No, Jeremy Renner, he was the one with
the
bow and arrow.
The bow and arrow,
he was the one who was
trying to decide whether or not he was going to shoot Thor.
Yeah.
Well, from the Hurt Locker, that guy.
Oh, okay, yeah. I wondered if that was
else. That was Hawkeye.
Yeah. Okay.
I was really disappointed in Agent Coulson, who...
I don't know what an Agent Coulson is.
He's the guy that... has been
is he the main S.H.I.E.L.D. guy?
Yes. The one that's been in everything. Mm-hmm. He's had, like, cameos in the other ones, and this he actually had a very prominent role, and he kind of came across as a big weenie.
Okay.
I actually really like him.
Yeah.
As an actor and this character.
I think he's been playing
it
well.
Yeah, I agree.
I clearly must... He mustn't have made an impression on me.
So he's the main S.H.I.E.L.D. guy.
He's the one who had him in Interrogation Room.
Okay.
But I guess I don't.
I mean, he's been in Iron Man. He's been in Hulk. He's been in. He was in Iron Man 2. I know he was in Hulk, but it's not. I'm looking at his IMDb thing right now. I know that he was in some of the other ones. Now, did Stan Lee show up in this?
He did. Yeah, he's the one who pulled the truck off.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I did not recognize him.
That's funny.
You know what? To be fair, though, he was on screen for all of about a second and a half.
Yeah.
So,
but we both recognize him.
But,
so, the funniest line in my head of the movie was one that wasn't actually said, which is when Natalie Portman is over him, and he, well, spoiler, I guess, he's dead for a minute, and she's you know, crouched over him with all the drama and crying, and I just wanted to say, but he was so hot. Seriously, that was their whole big love story, is she saw him with his shirt off. That was it.
Well, and that's the thing, in the original,
yeah.
Jane Foster, he was a doctor. Jane Foster was his nurse.
So they have a long relationship.
They had a long relationship in the original comic.
Yeah, this movie, they fall in love in 2 days. And then,
which,
like,
is
they're both like
every other Hollywood movie.
Yeah, that didn't bother me as much as it bothered everyone else, too. I mean, it wasn't particularly well written, but... It
certainly bothers Colleen.
Yeah, she thought it was dumb, too. So.
Okay,
she wasn't even there. I will say, so my final thoughts, I thought it was a horrible movie too, but I really enjoyed it. And
okay.
So, you know, I wouldn't say it's bad, but it was pretty bad.
Okay,
I wouldn't say it was bad.
It was pretty bad, but it was still easily enjoyable.
Okay. Florence, final words.
I back it as the 5 piece, but
okay.
I was very happy to have the excuse to watch it and then talk about it.
Well, thank goodness for that. We were happy to have you on. Well, there you have it. That's our take on Kenneth Branagh's Thor, a movie I guess I clearly appreciated a lot more than you guys did. So if you agree or disagree with any of our thoughts on this movie, or if you have any thoughts you'd like to share on anything else we've talked about on the show, please feel free to email us at filmconfessional@gmail.com. So let's move on to our final segment. As movie lovers, we all have a secret we are afraid to tell other people. Maybe you think Iron Man 2 was superior to the original. Maybe the blockbuster you're most highly anticipating this summer doesn't have a numeral at the end of it, the title. Whatever it be, secrets here at the Film Confessional are not allowed, and they must be put on the table. So Marty was supposed to be kicking off this segment, but he had to walk out with Colleen. So let's just go down the line. Jason, would you care to share your confession?
My confession? Oh, gosh.
Do we need to come back to you?
Yeah, I'll come back to me.
You had over an hour to figure this out. Florence, should I go or should you?
You should.
Does no one prepare for this damn thing?
I had a pick.
Okay. Fortunately,
do you have a new confession now?
Well, I do now. No, my confession is related to summer movies, specifically the summer movies that are coming out this weekend. There are two sort of releases that have considerable notoriety attached to them for very different reasons, and that are coming out. And so one is obviously the new Pirates of the Caribbean movie. And, you know, this is one that the reason it's so anticipated is because of, frankly, it's a Pirates of the Caribbean movie. I mean, everyone is going to, everyone who's seen it has already seen the first three, and they are looking forward to this upcoming one. And, you know, for the most part, the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise is a franchise I admire slightly, or I had a lot of fun with the first one at the very least, and I've stuck around. But, and then there's another one movie that's coming out that's had considerable notoriety for very different reasons, called The Beaver, which is directed by Jodie Foster, and it stars Mel Gibson, where he basically... Mel Gibson is depressed, and it's a black comedy, and he works through his therapy with this puppet, with this beaver, and he talks through the puppet the whole time. So, you know, those are the two movies that are coming out, and, you know, I have to say, of those two, I'm seeing a movie this weekend. It is not going to be the Pirates of the Caribbean movie. You know, as much as I, as much affection as I have, and probably more affection than the series really deserves.
Well, definitely the affection after the third one.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I just am so disillusioned by this franchise after in the wake of this fourth movie coming out. I feel like it couldn't possibly be more unnecessary, even more unnecessary than most forequels that come out. And
forequels,
yeah, as opposed to threequels.
Yeah, I don't approve of that word.
Well, good for you.
I don't approve of either words, actually.
And you know, and it's so interesting because I do have that initial sort of investment in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, whereas with the Beaver, the creative force behind that, interestingly enough, is from a director and a lead actress who hasn't really impressed me in anything all that recently. Though in her defense, she hasn't exactly been prolific. And its leading man is a person who I, in general, feel like he's a pretty despicable human being in so many different respects.
I did not know that it was directed by Jodie Foster.
Yes.
And that seems like such a strange pairing to me at this
point.
Yeah,
and she's actually been really, it's really been detrimental, I think, to her position and career because she spent a lot of time publicly trying to defend him in promoting this movie, and it's just making her look bad, and he's continuing to be irredeemable in terms of PR. But I have to say, I really have a lot of affection and respect for her.
Me too.
And I've heard it's a good movie. I hope the movie fails miserably and that no one else makes movies with Mel Gibson. I hope that box office can tell them that he's no longer bankable and
Well, the movie is not doing well box office wise.
They keep making the movies with Tom Cruise.
That's what I mean. I mean, that's box office is going to be what tells them to stop doing it.
Well, that.
Although, I honestly think that the studios, even when box office is miserable, if it is anything that they can. It's very strange. They put all their money into sequels and franchises and stuff. They put all their money into the marketing and stuff. But then when a movie fails, it's like they try and blame everybody except for the fact that it might be a bad movie.
Yeah.
They blame piracy. They blame, just what else is opening. Everything except that, we made a bad decision.
Yeah.
Well, this one's not getting terrible reviews by any stretch of the imagination, but it is not doing well, and I think it's because Gibson has become box office poison because of the narrative that's sort of been constructed around him. And, you know, for me, as someone who regularly blogs and about movies and writes about movies, who actually enjoys being able to keep up on the discussion, I don't have... And this is a much bigger discussion that I would love to have on the show at some point, but I don't have that sort of qualm about putting my money on the table to be able to talk about this movie, mm-hmm. because I think there is a level of effectiveness to have that sort of, punditry power to some extent. I mean, as much punditry power as I have as on my own little blog that no one visits, but...
I've been there.
Yeah. But, you know, to me, I'd rather... You know, I'd rather be able to talk intelligently about the movie than necessarily to work with the hype that is working against the movie.
Well, and, I have my confession.
Okay, and I will say I completely think what you are... I will say completely what you're saying, Florence, is completely valid. So I hope you don't think I'm saying, no, you are completely wrong. I just... You know, the way I prefer to consume, film and to consume the sort of general discourse surrounding film, I'd rather be directly involved as much as I can.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, does your confession segue into mine? Okay, well, why don't we hear yours?
My confession is that I have been boycotting Woody Allen movies for well over a decade.
They're terrible?
No, because I find it objectionable that he basically started an affair with his stepdaughter.
Okay.
And that has bothered me so much that I have refused to see even his acclaimed movies. I think I saw Sleeper when I was a kid, and maybe one of his others before all that happened. But that's been it for me.
Sure. Well, you know, that is a really interesting discussion. I was trying to skirt that larger discussion a little bit, just because I wanted to have a bigger discussion about it sometime on the show. But I will say that. You know, that is such a difficult conversation for me to navigate, partly because I do have, I mean, for me, I already talked about why I have no qualms about seeing those movies, even though I consider the artist's behavior outside of that particular text to be morally repellent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, regards to that, I don't necessarily have qualms about putting, you know, putting money on the table to see their films for the reasons we explained. But at the same time, it is so difficult to draw, you know, to draw that line. Like, it is so difficult because I think another example, maybe the more famous one, is Roman Polanski, for example.
Oh, yeah,
I mean, he's...
I certainly also like...
Yeah, he's another guy who, you know, and who did a really terrible thing. And I think, for the most part, he did sort of weasel his way out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I cannot... It is so hard for me to deny the fact that I think Rosemary's Baby is one of the greatest horror films of all time. I can't deny the fact that, you know, I'm sorry, as, you know, loathsome as I think his behavior was, it is not going to stop me from seeing Christoph Waltz and Kate Winslet in the movie that he's directing them in, God of Carnage, which is based on a really popular play as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I completely sympathize and understand and admire, you know, that sort of, you know, that sort of moral objection to supporting a particular artist. I don't know if I'm copping out personally. I'm just, you know, using the preface of, you know, my desire to write about film, but...
I mean, I actually don't, I'm not offended at all by your approach, and I would say that there are many, many objectionable things in popular culture I do not like that. But these are, you know, the lines in the sand that mean something to me.
Yeah.
Did you happen to read the Tegan Lynn Sarah, well, the Sarah article about a rapper whose name escapes me. Sarah of Tegan and Sarah wrote this article about a rapper who has many homophobic remarks in his song, and it's getting tons of people writing about it and stuff like that. And,
Is it the not gay thing?
I don't remember.
Or no homo or whatever.
No. This is even more recent than that.
It's really not up to date.
Yeah, I don't know anything about this.
We'll find it.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's an example. Is the amount of homophobia in the hip hop industry, and yet it's not going away because people say, you know, it's part of the hip-hop culture.
There is a lot of really awesome, politically savvy hip-hop culture out there that does not get radio play. I mean, POS is a local example of someone I really like and admire, and Spearhead is another example. I mean, there is definitely really good hip-hop whose content is also not objectionable. And I think that it's easy to gloss over that fact if all you listen to is the radio.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll have a deeper discussion on that at some point, too, because I'd love to talk about how despicable Leni Riefenstahl is, but she still managed to evoke maybe the most gorgeous imagery I've ever seen in film, but maybe that's for another time.
Okay.
Anyway, do you know who Leni Riefenstahl is? She was the one who made all of Hitler's propaganda films.
Ah, okay.
Okay. Anyway, so Jason, I don't think Marty's going to make it for this segment, so why don't you wrap things up for us?
All right. Well, this ties back to my spotlight pick in that the two movies that I think I'm looking forward to most this summer are actually sequels.
Uh-oh. Blasphemer.
I know. One of them being...
X-Men?
No.
Oh, okay.
Harry Potter.
Oh, ugh. Yeah.
Who cares anymore? I'm sorry.
Hello, my confession. Leave me alone.
That's all I was going to say.
Cars 2.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Well, it's a new Pixar movie, and I actually liked Cars a lot better than I ever thought I would.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of affection for Cars. And, I mean, part of it is that this is another confession in that I have been so disappointed in Hollywood over the past couple of years that I have kind of stopped reading up on what is coming out lately. Even when it comes to independent and foreign films. So I generally, at this point, I'm basically saying I don't know a whole lot about what's coming out this year, except I know that the new Harry Potter and Cars 2 is coming out.
Sure.
And so I'm there are plenty of better movies that are going to be coming out over the rest of the year, especially as we get closer to the end of the year and the Oscar movies start coming out. And, you know, if I was looking at, say, IndieWire and, you know, all these things.
IndieWire is great. Like,
for, you know, the various things that I would enjoy are coming out. But because reading about film these days kind of depresses me, I don't. And, you know, these are the ones that are at the top of my radar. And as far as Harry Potter, you're right. I mean, I have said before that I really am much more interested in what the next iteration of Harry Potter is going to be, which I really think is going to be a serialized BBC production of some sort. Again, it's kind of ironic. I feel like kind of a hypocrite, but there's going to be such a big hoopla around the last Harry Potter.
I mean, you want to be part of that. That sort of hype is infectious.
It is. Completely, you know, I have my Harry Potter sweater, which I won't be able to wear because I'm going to be on the Red Ribbon ride.
Oh.
And we're going to sneak out into Rochester to see it, not at the midnight show because I'll be asleep, but after the ride on Friday, we'll be going into Rochester to watch it. So.
Well, those are good. And you know what? I am looking forward to Harry Potter too, like, as disdainfully as I reacted to your confession, but
you acted disdainfully, really? seemed it was like a natural reaction.
But no, I mean, we talked about the Harry Potter thing a little bit when the first part of Part 7 came out. You know, I just feel that, you know, I'm seeing these now more. It seems more perfunctory than anything. I'm just trying to get it out of my system. But and then Cars 2, like, Cars is my least favorite Pixar movies,
yeah,
personally,
so
I will still see it, and I am still hopeful that it'll actually be better than the first one, because I think that creatively Pixar has reached such amazing heights. I can't see that not rubbing off on this Cars franchise.
I'm kind of curious as to how Cars 2 is going to make me cry.
Yeah,
since the last, like, five Pixar movies have all made, well, not five, three, have all made me cry. Toy Story 3, Up, WALL-E. So the last three.
Okay.
What?
Nothing.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. So, no, I think that's actually a good confession.
What was before WALL-E?
Before WALL-E was Ratatouille.
Yeah, Ratatouille didn't make me cry.
But I liked it more than, pretty much all of them I like more than I think I will.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that a lot of them, I have to give Pixar credit. They're not going to make a movie that I'm not going to enjoy. Even if it's not going to be my favorite Pixar movie, I'm still going to enjoy it.
Yep.
I have to say this, have you been following the, moving to Independent Fair, have you been following the coverage for the Cannes Film Festival that's going on right now?
Only Roger Ebert's tweets.
Okay. Well, I need to show you the trailer for Almodovar's new film, Skin, that I Live In. It's out. It's only 30 seconds, but it gets you crazy excited for the movie, or at least it did for me.
Right.
So I'm going to show that to you.
Okay.
So.
Sure.
Okay. Marty, you just walked in, so why don't you close up our film confession segment?
We're expecting something big.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking about how can I top all the other things that I don't like, and I'll just say, I don't like dramas.
Wow. And the reason
why... Do you also not like kittens?
The reason why I say wow is because, and I know I'm stealing your thunder a little bit here, but I've been bicycling to and from work with someone. We had this conversation yesterday on the way home from work where he's like, I don't like dramas. Drama, if I want drama... I have drama in my own life. I don't want to see other people's drama.
Yeah, exactly.
It sounds like such a Woody Allen thing to say.
Anyway, go on, Marty. Tell us, why do you not like drama?
You know, I don't know.
You don't.
I don't know why I don't like it. It's one of those things where I feel like, you know, intellectually there are movies that I know I should like, and there are a lot of dramas that I do actually end up enjoying.
How do you define
and
drama?
And I feel like they, that's a good question.
Well, I know how you define it, because it's the same way that Seamus defines it. It's a serious movie that takes place in the real world with no science fiction or fantastical elements.
that would qualify as things that I do not like.
Yeah.
I mean, I would go a little bit further, though, and I would say where the main thrust of the movie is dramatic. Like, where it's, it is
drama.
Yeah, exactly. Where it's meant to invoke some kind of emotional response that is not, like, humor or, humor isn't even really an emotional response.
I think laughing certainly is an emotional response to an extent, every bit as much as fear. I mean,
intellectual response.
Yeah. Whereas, I mean, to you, what is less meaningful about the experiences that you, the feelings that
you know,
are evoked in a drama?
That's the thing, I fully acknowledge that, in fact, they are probably more meaningful. And especially if
especially if they're examining
what makes them emotional, you know, like what one, you know, like some kind of like I find that interesting. I find it interesting when they're sort of examining like a whole broad topic of like, you know, what makes, I don't know why, but I can't think of a single example, but you know, it feels like, you know, there are movies that explore what it means to be human versus
the human condition.
Right. Yeah, and I find those actually a lot more interesting than I find, you know, I guess. So for me, the kind of movie that sort of epitomizes what I'm talking about is the human interest movie, the movie that's about like, you know, some historical figure or
like biopics or
which
is the most banal genre in film. Right behind the romantic comedy.
Right, and the tearjerker.
Yeah.
I mean, like, those are just genres that I, you know, if I never seen one, I would be fine. I don't know. There are a lot of things I dislike.
Well, you know what, I think maybe...
So many podcasts to come.
Right. Yeah.
I mean...
But I also feel like this one is such a, like, a guy thing to say. Like,
You know what? I can identify with you.
Problem with Hollywood right now.
Yeah.
I think I can identify with you to an extent. Like, for me, I have a hard time getting invested in a lot of comedies because I think so often there is this, what we define as comedy is a movie that has the setup punchline sort of formula, and it goes consistently throughout. And I don't think a movie necessarily has to be funny follow that formula to be funny, to evoke something, mm-hmm. to evoke laughs from me. So, to an extent, I can understand where you're coming from in the sense that, you know, it doesn't excite you because it doesn't elicit reactions from you in a way that's as meaningful mm-hmm. as it might be to a lot of other people.
You know, it's interesting too, though, because I think I feel particularly susceptible to tearjerkers. And I hate
that should have been another confession. So, well,
no, it's interesting because I hear what you're saying. I see where you're coming from. It feels like you're stabbing me in the soul a little bit. With this.
Well, since we don't have time to have an hour-long discussion about it, what was the conclusion of your conversation yesterday?
Pretty much, we just stopped talking.
You kind of have to agree to disagree
at
some point. Those conversations have no end.
Really, it's like, you know, I mean, he pretty much says that, well, essentially what it came down to was that he only goes to see science fiction in the theater because of wanting to see the special effects on the big screen.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's no good watching special effects on the small screen, and thus he doesn't pay to go see dramas in the on the big screen because there's no point. But then he doesn't like dramas anyways and just generally doesn't watch them. He doesn't read books. He doesn't like stories that are set in the real world, so to speak.
Yeah.
There has to be something that is
extraordinary,
yeah.
So what you're saying is you should really invite him over next time and come over to hang out with Marty.
You need to think of these real world presentations as ideological diegeses, and then you can sort of make that really labored sort of parallel to science fiction worlds.
Yeah, my thought is that, you know, it's basically discounting so much good storytelling, good stories by saying, oh, it's the real world, but I don't like it.
Yeah. Well, and I think for me anyway, everything has the possibility of transcending its genre. So there are certainly dramas that I like, and you know, but I think only because they themselves have become extraordinary through their storytelling or some other aspect.
Well,
whereas a good science fiction film does not have to be extraordinary.
Which was one of your confessions a few months ago, I think.
Yeah.
But no, I think you're really onto something. I mean, if you're going to talk about film or any sort of artistic medium in a meaningful way, you have to talk about your personal biases,
mm-hmm.
For or against specific genre. Otherwise, you know, you're not necessarily being truthful in your conversations. So,
right. So
regardless of how incendiary what your declaration was, Marty, I think we all definitely appreciate you sharing with us your confession. And those are our film confessions for this week. Don't forget to send us your thoughts on this week's episode or any episode by emailing filmconfessional@gmail.com.
You can also find us on Facebook, where we regularly post updates and links to our latest episodes. Just go to facebook.com and type the Film Confessional Podcast in search engine.
We're also posting updates on Twitter. If you want to follow us, we encourage you to do so. You can find us at twitter.com/filmconfessions.
And don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes. You can find additional information about the Film Confessional Podcast at www.filmconfessional.com.
Web and technical support for the Film Confessional blog and podcast is brought to you by Aiden Web Services, providing marketing and consulting services to the nonprofits and small businesses in the Twin Cities area. For more information, visit AidenWebServices.com. That's AIDAN, WebServices.com. Be sure to tune in for next week's episode when we're just going to have a killer discussion. Jason, do we know what we're discussing yet?
The Killers by John Woo. No.
I don't think so. We're going to have to discuss what that's going to be.
No.
We'll have to figure out what that's going to be, and then we'll post it in the show notes, I guess.
Yes.
So, which,
what's coming out this weekend?
Nothing. Pirates. Yeah. This Pirates movie.
Pirates movie.
That was my confession. I'm not seeing that this weekend. But
so you can't talk about it next week?
No. We'll come up with something.
We'll just talk about the trailer, just because the trailer is essentially the movie cut down to 2 minutes, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So, well, anyway, in the next week, we leave you with the wise words of Odin, the Odin speak, as it were, or Odin quote. He says, "Responsibility, duty, honor, these are not mere virtues to which one must aspire. They are essential to every soldier, to every king." I think that's how Anthony Hopkins said it. Well, until next time, this is Justin.
I'm Jason.
I'm Florence.
And Marty.
And this has been a joint effort of the Film Confessional Podcast and the Read Comics Podcast. Thanks for listening.
Bye.